Welcome to the Kingdom Roots Podcast with Scott McKnight, the conversation designed to look at how the kingdom took root then and how it's taking root now. Today on the podcast, we are continuing our conversation on Scott's book, Pastor Paul, Nurturing a Culture of Christiformity in the Church. Are making our way through the seven examples that demonstrate how nurturing Christiformity was at the heart of the Pauline mission. And today we're going to look at Paul's Culture of World Subversion, which is a great title for a chapter. And then you start by saying that sometimes the pastor has to subvert if nurturing Christiformity is the task. So pastors are subversive. Tell us what you mean by that.
Oh, it's an amazing, I use an amazing statement from Eugene Peterson when he said most of the individuals in this amalgam, he calls his congregation, suppose that the goals they have for themselves and the goals God has for them are the same. And I say that he sounds just like C.S. Lewis with this. It is the oldest religious mistake, refusing to countenance any real difference between God and us, imagining God to be a vague extrapolation of our own desires, and then hiring a priest to manage the affairs between self and the extrapolation. And I, one of the priests they hired, am having none of it. But if I'm not willing to help them become what they want to be, what am I doing taking their pay? I am being subversive. So that's part, and I think we have to be careful here. I think a lot of young, fresh seminary graduates enter into churches and they think, I'm gonna do it right. And everybody else has been doing it wrong. And I'm going to show them how to do it. And we're going to get right back to Jesus and discipleship and spiritual formation. And they get all these utopian ideals. And that's not the way to start out with a church. I often say, you need to just listen for 2 years and keep things calm for a couple of years. But most don't have the patience to do that. But a genuine pastor who preaches the Bible, and especially if they have the value, the opportunity to use a lectionary, because it's going to be coming from so many different angles over time, rather than just say, preach Galatians or Sermon on the Mount or something. Every pastor who preaches honestly will subvert the hidden assumptions and worldliness that is at work in the church, in their local church. There will be moments when the pastor has to say things that are going to make some people, if not most people in the church, uncomfortable. And that's part of what it's about. I do want to emphasize, Laura, I think you understand this. I do want to emphasize that it's easy for some to think that that's their sole task, is to be a prophetic voice. Prophetic voices are valuable when they are a part of a trusted voice that has been pastoral. But all prophecy, let's say, always speaking words of prophecy, is just either going to get people in your church all riled up all the time, which means they're a caucus rather than a church, and it will not lead to spiritual formation. It'll just lead to some kind of resistance or dissidence or even anger and hatred. But I really believe that the best prophetic words are uttered by people who have gained the trust of the congregation. It can penetrate the deepest that way.
That's good. Yeah, and I think this is really timely, because I think there are a lot of things that a lot of our churches have beliefs that the pastors want to challenge and should challenge. But the way that we do it matters as much as the fact that we should do it. So there's both things at work. And I think we see that in the example of Paul. Paul said some pretty hard things to the churches that he was in relationship with.
Yeah.
But and sometimes it was received better than others. but he was really leaning into the relationships he'd already formed. He was counting on the strength of those relationships to carry the weight of the hard words he sometimes needed to say.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. I mean, it's really difficult to work from Paul's letters to how he normally communicated with people in the congregations, the little house churches, how he spoke, what his tone was. It's very different. It's so easy to impose our tone on Paul or Jesus or someone else, Peter, rather than just to admit ignorance that we really don't know. And I think Paul could be strident at times, but I think there's a lot of pastoral compassion and empathy in that man as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Well, you look at Paul's interaction with the church in Corinth.
You talk about
just that the Corinthian church had a very strong sense of honor and shame, and that they had sort of a competition for honor, that this was very common in Roman culture. And Paul is sort of coming up against this idea. And you talked about how people in the Roman Empire boasted about their social status. And this was acceptable. This was common practice. This was encouraged. And this is something that Paul wants to challenge. He wants to address. Yeah. But tell us a little bit about how Paul did this. How did Paul approach it?
Well, one of the things that we have to understand about Corinth is its sense of Romanitas. Corinth was filled with people who wanted to be like Rome. And so imitating Rome and the system systemically, you know, we like this word systemic today. Systemically, Corinth was trying to be Rome. And part of that process was to rise in what's called the cursus honorum, or was to rise for the men to rise up and become someone significant in the community, someone with status and honor and glory. And this was the motivation, the drive, the passion of a lot of people, and their families were connected to them, their wives, their children. So it was not just a male thing. It was a male thing, but they dragged with them everybody in their family. And Paul somehow, and I know we'll get to some of what you were asking about, but somehow, I mean, Paul had said enough things that they really criticized him. And one day, I read through 2 Corinthians 10 through 13, and I would never encourage a pastor to do this on Monday, but maybe on break or when they are feeling confident and can handle it, just read 2 Corinthians 10 to 13, and as you read it, think of what Paul is responding to from the Corinthians and what they're accusing him of. Yeah. It is ruthless. It's brutal. And Paul put up with a lot. But at the heart of their opposition to Paul was his refusal to play the game of Romanitas, the idea of becoming a glorious, honor-filled, status-driven Roman Christian. Paul wanted no part of that. And I don't think I've exaggerated this. And I tried to measure this against some of the best scholarship that I know of on the Corinthian letters. And to me, Paul routinely is aware of how the Corinthians are operating, and he is out to sack their sense of honor and to knock it off the pedestal. It's almost like Paul says, you people want to become, you know, to use the language of our former president, you want to make Corinth great again. You want to make your family great again. So they're on this quest of greatness, and that means status and honor. And status is not simply achievement. Status is how you are perceived in your society. It's a cultural location. And no matter if you operated according to your cultural location, you brought honor to yourself, and you were supposed to bring honor to yourself. And therefore, you could boast about your honor because it was connected to who you were and where you belonged and where you were located in that society. And Paul wants status and honor to be subverted because Christ subverted his own status, and God has identified with us, and Christ became poor for our sakes so that others might become rich. Mm-hmm. So Paul almost plays a game of let's find someone of high status and let's challenge them to act contrary to their status and do something that subverts their status. So you're famous for your speaking. Don't be so proud about your public, you know, whatever it was. Paul wanted them to subvert the quest for glory as Romanitas, and he wanted them instead to glorify God. And so, I don't know if I'm getting close to what you're...
Yeah, well, as you're talking, I'm thinking about how in Corinth you had families and households that were sort of vying for this honor and status. And it gets me thinking about, like, we're house churches doing this, competing with one another to be the best church. I don't know if any of Paul's churches had that sense at work, but I'm thinking about modern day churches and how that sometimes takes place, where we do it mm-hmm. best here. We have the best church. We have the best programs. We have the best leadership. You know, this sense of pride in what we have to offer. I've seen that in work. I call it
the who's got game.
Yes.
Who's got the biggest church? Go ahead.
And I've seen that at work in some towns, you know, that kind of sense of like, we're the biggest church in town, or we have the best programs, or everybody's, you know, looking to us. And it just seems so anti-Christ, anti-Christian mm-hmm. to me, that sort of sense of pride in our church. Like, I get loyalty. I get the sense of belonging and connection, and that there is a sense of pride and connection, like, just like you have a sense of pride in your family. But I think that we have to be very careful that pride is connection to Christ. It's mm-hmm. it's connection to Christ's church. And on a global sense, I think we just have to be careful about, you know, pitting churches against one another. Seems really strange to me.
Well, I do think that there was competition in Corinth. And we see that probably at the beginning of 1 Corinthians, where, you know, I am of Apollos, I am of Paul. I don't think this is theology so much as it is laying claim to the patron that they saw as a personality cult. Then there is this sense that the Corinthians are obviously offended that Paul has not taken money from them. And this has been quite a quest by scholars who study the collection and who study money in Paul, that I think the consensus is that Paul refused to take money from churches as they were forming. Mm. Once they were formed and became, in a sense, financially independent or financially soluble or something, mature, he would take gifts from them for the mission. Mm. But I don't know how much Paul actually took and used from the local churches, especially when he was serving among them, which is what he's trying to do is avoid two things. He's trying to avoid the sense that he's doing this for money. And the other thing is the Corinthians were taking pride in their capacity to fund a well-known philosopher. It's almost like they say, we have employed Aristotle, the Aristotle of the Christian world, the Plato of the Christian world. We have employed him here in our church, the Cicero of the Christian group. And they could take pride in having this sort of the great speaker, the great theologian employed at their church. You know, if someone today, think about this, if some church could hire N.T. Wright, you know,
yeah,
they would be so excited. Proud, but so proud. And Paul would say, that's what I'm talking about right there.
Yeah.
That sense of pride and honor that we have the best. And Paul wanted to subvert that because that's not to be the goal of the Christian. The goal of the Christian, the leaders in those churches, is to serve their community, whether they get any glory out of it or not. And in fact, the big thing is, I mean, one of the big things that Paul subverts is money in 2 Corinthians. We've already looked at this theme of generosity.
Yeah.
But he subverts some of their ideas about money because he uses Christ as a model that he gave himself up. He was rich and became poor, not the flip of being poor and became rich. And he also makes it very clear that in that world, when you were benevolent toward other people, you would get a statue or you would get your name engraved on a stone, on a building, on bricks outside your church, you know. And Paul said, no, all the glory, and he uses the words that are constantly used for honor and glory in the Roman world as Romanitas. He uses the words for glory that goes to God. So not only does he subvert the Roman system of honor that comes to people who are benevolent, but he rips all the honor out and says all the honor goes to God. So even if you were benevolent, we're not going to give you any credit. You know, we're not going to do it that way. And I was in college when I first realized this. And I remember a pastor urging people to give money. And if you gave money, that we would inscribe your name on a brick. And if you gave a lot of money, on a marble stone that would be the foundation of the new building that we are building. And I, Chris and I walk by the high school 2 times a day now. And on the football field are these donors.
Yeah.
Downtown in the middle of Libertyville, there are bricks with people's names on them who donated bricks. And I think these are all good things. I'm really glad. But every time I see those, I think of Paul saying,
yeah,
nope, you give the money and we will erase your name from the brick. And we're going to put God on it. And that's all that matters to you. And yeah, that is a metaphor for world subversion for the Apostle
Paul.
Yeah,
that's good. That's good. Well, and I think at one point you write that Paul is going after their terms and definitions of status and honor. And he's saying, you know, all you have all you want and you are rich and you are kings, like that's so great for all of you. But then he shows that in their terms and in their definitions, Paul himself is a loser.
Yeah.
In the sense that he doesn't have titles. He's not rich. He's none of these things. So Paul is offering himself as an example of this inversion of status and honor and glory, and holding this up as a model for them of what they should be attempting.
Yeah, I'm trying to find, titles and images. The passage that Paul uses is, we have become like the rubbish of the world. There's a church in Denver called, this is no kidding, the name of the, at least it was, there was a church in Denver, it may still exist, may not, called the Scum of the Earth.
Yeah.
And it's taken from this verse, 1 Corinthians 4:13. And the dregs of all things to this very day. And Paul says in 2 Corinthians that he leads us as captives. And then he brags about weakness. And he loves the idea that we are God's foolishness, fools, that God chose what is low and despised. We are clay jars. We're servants. We're farmers. We're artisan builders. And so Paul's terms for himself are so much counter to the way we use terms in our churches today. You know?
Right.
Okay. I'll tell a personal story. But this struck me as so important at my time in life, and I've carried it on. When I was teaching at Trinity as a young professor, I did not, when I first started, I did not have a PhD. I was finishing my doctorate. Mm-hmm. And so students called me Scott, all right, because, or some of them called me Mister, which is a high school language, which I didn't like.
Yeah.
And some would call me professor, but most would call me by my first name. And then I got my PhD. I finished and it passed. And I remember a student asking me in class, do we now call you doctor? And if they did before that, I would say, I hope you're a prophet. I hope you're a prophet. But they asked me if they should call me doctor. Well, at the time, I was a specialist in the Gospel of Matthew. And Matthew 23 has this very piercing passage. Don't let anybody call you rabbi. Don't call teacher. You know, you have one teacher. You have Jesus. And I remember thinking, okay, no, I want you to call me Scott. And I always said, that's what my mom and dad called me, and that's what you call me. And I stuck with that. Now, when I got to teaching undergrads, in fact, at Trinity, most of the professors went by doctor, and I don't remember anyone insisting on it, but I suppose there were some. When I got to North Park, the students called me by my first name because that was how they did, and I thought, oh, maybe a little bit more respect here is in order at times, but I have always believed that we should treat one another as brothers and sisters in Christ and go by first names. Mm. Now, you know Justin Gill, one of my TAs. He's now a graduate and down. He's now working with the school. He still calls me Dr. McKnight. And I said, Justin, one of these days you're going to have to call me Scott. And he says, no. That day hasn't arrived. So he and his little kids still call me that as well, Dr. McKnight. So, but I really believe that there is a quest for titles, you know, Reverend, Canon, Very Reverend, a Bishop, you know, Archbishop, your, what do they say, your Majesty and stuff like
your
that.
Your Eminence.
Yeah. And I do not want to cast shade. Toss shade? Is that the expression that's so cool? I don't want to toss shade on the respect that that people have and that people feel in respect for other people. But at the same time, we need to check our status mongering and title mongering.
Yeah.
Here's another story that I think is totally appropriate. I tell this story in Blue Parakeet. Alice Shirey, one of my students, a long time ago, was beginning to preach at her church in Iowa. And she was called something like a minister or something like that. And after like 7 years, she went into the pastor and she made an amazing statement. I just love this statement. I grew up in a locker room in sports. She said to the pastor, I think it's time for me to turn in my JV uniform for a varsity uniform and be called pastor. And he said, you're right. So it was appropriate. I thought that was totally appropriate that this was not her desire to have status, but it was her desire for the church to recognize that she was a pastor and not a woman subordinate.
Right.
It was really important. So I do think Paul's words subvert our desire for titles, and we need to be aware of it.
We do. And it's titles are an interesting thing because I think they are attached to power. Yeah. So sometimes there's a withholding of the title as a way to hold power or assert power over.
You're right.
And sometimes people claim titles without the credentials behind them, which is a little shady. And we want to honor, but titles are also a way to honor people. And so I think that, you know, I do know, like, sometimes with female professors, I'm much more inclined to include their honorific because I know how hard they worked for it. And I know that, to me, I want to honor the effort and the, exceptional obstacles they may have faced. Like, I want to celebrate that with them.
So you want to say Dr. Kohick?
I almost always call her Dr. Kohick. Yes. Okay. Because to me, that is, I feel like she worked hard for that. I want to honor that.
Oh, yeah, she did. She did.
But, you know, and even I remember in the first class with you that you said, call me Scott. And I was like, that goes so against my grain of, like, respect, you know. Mm-hmm. But I do appreciate that sense of emphasizing that we're brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. And as Christ followers, we're called to be equal before the cross. We're called to care for one another. So we're in these interesting relationships of equality, but also, like, there's also respect. That's a piece of that.
I really like what you've just said here. I think that, let's just say Dr. Kohick or Dr. Farrell, they grew up in a world where they were not going to be called those things by men in an academic world because they were women.
Yeah.
So the use of that honorific or that title is a way of making a statement that we believe that we are brothers and sisters in Christ, and you have achieved what was formerly not achievable, and we want to honor you with that. And I think if the person says, but please call me by my first name, then I think that's entirely appropriate. And I do think that it is wise for students to ask, what should we call you? Mm-hmm. I think I try to establish this in the first 15 minutes in a classroom to try to make it comfortable for people, but I don't resist when someone insists on, I mean, it's not very common anymore, but I really like what you said, that I do think that there's something for women or for African Americans or Latin Americans or Asian Americans who have been deprived of those sorts of positions and status qualifiers in our culture. Mm-hmm. To be given that honor, because it's almost like those people are able to say, we have arrived.
Yeah.
We have achieved. I really like that. I'm glad you brought that up.
Mm-hmm. In a weird way, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, I almost wonder if it's an aspect of this world subversion, in the sense that calling... Like, I'm thinking of my friends when I got the title Reverend. Yeah. How many of my female friends in particular, like, changed my name in their address book and put Reverend in front of it, you know, because for them, it's exciting to see that something like that could happen and does happen. And so they're much more likely to call it out and to use it, because I think it is overturning some expectations.
You're right. It subverts the worldliness of male patriarchal power.
Right.
It does that by calling Dr. Ingrid Farrell, Dr. Farrell. You subvert that's only for men. Mm-hmm. It's a subversion of male power, and puts it where it should be.
Right.
In an egalitarian framework. And I think that's really cool that your friends in their address changed it to Reverend Laura Taro. Yes. You've been through a lot of this lately.
Yes, yes.
These qualification things you've had to go through.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Well, I do think this idea of Paul, the other thing that really struck me in this chapter was the thought that the Corinthians were complaining about Paul's rhetorical skills. And he kind of takes on that discussion and he doesn't defend himself. He's not in a hurry to sort of, list his qualifications or present himself as this fabulous speaker. Instead, he sort of says, you write that he degraded himself in his rhetorical skills because he wanted both to subvert the Corinthians' worldly status measurements and to focus on Christ and the cross. And so you write to pastors that God loves the ordinary too, and we should focus on being faithful and forget being great. Mm-hmm. And so I thought about this idea in terms of preaching, because there's a lot of pressure on pastors to mm-hmm. have very eloquent preaching capabilities. And I do think that as practitioners, we should aim for our best in order to honor Christ. But I also think it's okay to say, I'm okay with being faithful and doing my best, but I don't need to be like some other brilliant preacher. I don't need to feel bad about that because I'm being faithful to Christ. Because I'm thinking of Paul, and he's sort of like, you're right. I'm not a fabulous philosopher. I'm faithful to Christ, and that's what matters.
You know, I think this is an amazing part of Paul. And I think there's a side to it where if you read Philemon, you go, that was pretty clever.
Yeah.
And you read you read Romans and you go, well, this guy's not too bad. I mean, he can keep up with pretty fast paced ideas and it really clips along. Mm-hmm. Okay. And he makes some jumps in Romans 9 through 11 that are very difficult even to this day to follow. But it's dense. So I do think Paul had rhetorical skills.
Yeah.
But I do believe also that Paul refused to play the rhetorical oratory game that the Corinthians wanted. Now, how do we apply this in our world? All right. I believe that we have to become, all right, now let's just say, you're young. You want to hone your preaching skills, and it's going to take 10 years. So just in case you want to know, it's going to take you 10 years.
It's a long time.
Now, some people are a little bit faster, but, it takes a while to integrate biblical knowledge, theological competence, exegesis and exposition, the text that you have to look at, and your congregation to where you can blend them together into a message that really speaks the word of God to your congregation, but is faithful to Scripture. You don't go to seminary and come out. We don't spit people out who can do that every week. That takes a decade of really good work. And some people are really funny and good speakers when they're 25, but they still don't have pastoral gifts yet where they're integrating. Okay. I think that there comes a point where you say, I'm pretty good at this. And I think we can learn that we're pretty good by people saying to us very positive things after our preaching. And I believe also that as we grow in our skills of preaching and speaking, that we have learned how to, let's say, control and say the right things at the right time that moves a congregation.
Yeah.
And some of that is really important and good. And other parts of it is just plain oratorical skill that brings us honor and glory. At that point right there, I think we need to practice the discipline of subversion. Mm. All right. Now, I have for years collected my favorite quotations, let's say 15 to 20 years, favorite quotations from really good writers. And I can, every time I speak, just sort through my, I call it a commonplace book. It's electronic, it's digital. I can sort through it and I can come up with some pretty good quotes, a little Marilyn Robinson here and Barbara Brown Taylor here.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite, you know, like George Orwell there and G.K. Chesterton here and Dorothy Sayers there. And it's pretty impressive to people. They go, wow, yeah. how did you remember all that? You know, well, I didn't, but it was impressive. And I think at that point, I believe we need to be very careful at conveying the image of how good we could be. And so we could practice the discipline of not doing that, of using our own words and not bringing in the timely quote. Now, some people would say, you know, there's some homiletics professors right now, just if they're listening to me, which they shouldn't be, but they could be. They'll shake in their head like, no, no, don't tell people to do that. Well, yes, it's about pride. Mm. It's about wanting to be seen as really good. Right. The desire to be seen as a really good preacher is not a cruciform desire.
Right.
Paul subverted that because that was what the Corinthians wanted out of him. And he said, it's not going to happen. So,
that's so good.
He may have not practiced his introduction and he may not have practiced his segue. What do you call them? Transitions from first point to second point. He may have just said, I'll just use an outline and see what happens. I don't know. Yeah. I do think that this is wise for us to be aware of.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's not an excuse for the first year preacher to be lazy.
That's
to
true
say,
too.
I don't want to be proud about myself. Well, I want to say to him, you don't have any worries about that right now.
Yes. I think our goal is Christ's glory.
That yes.
is yeah. yeah. Well, Scott, today we talked about the culture of world subversion, which was really fun. And next time on Kingdom Roots, we'll talk about the culture of wisdom. And we look forward to being with you next time as we continue our conversation on how the kingdom took root then and how it's taking root now. Thanks, everybody.